Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to Marshall Karp. He's written a new book called Kill Me If You Can. He and James Patterson have come out with this really neat thriller. It is actually at this moment the number one in the New York Times bestseller list. It's hard to believe, but it is. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. It's true.
I checked New York Times bestseller list 12 times. Since this morning, and it's still on there.
What does it feel like to have a number one New York Times bestseller?
That's a trick question. First, well, you know, it's interesting. I have to tell you, a lot of my friends are really excited. I'm sort of cooler about it because, essentially, I wrote a number one New York Times bestseller with James Patterson,
who we all think of as this god of writing.
Yeah, he is God. In fact, it's in my contract that I have to call him God or something like that. But I think the best part of it is I wrote a book with James Patterson, and I didn't take him off the New York Times bestseller list. It is a good feeling. It's a good feeling because when Jim asked me to do the book 2 years ago, one thought in my head, well, when Jim asked me to do the book a few years ago, I said, yeah, how much do I have to pay you?
Right.
You know, I knew that if the book were just published, it would be, intelligently edited by James, and that it would be marketed well by Little Brown, and it would be demanded by his legions of followers, and it would be number one. And I kind of knew that it would happen, and it feels good, but I do have a little bit of the feeling of riding someone's coattails. And when Jim called me last week to say, well, how does it feel to be a number one New York Times bestselling author, I said, well, it sort of feels like I'm taking it. He said, oh, God, the guilt. It spares no religion. You know, he said, just bask in it.
Right.
I said, how do you feel, Jim, about being a number one New York Times bestseller? And he said, I am delighted every single time. So I'm trying to get over my ethnic guilt and just enjoy it.
Well,
it is really cool, bro.
I'm sure it is. But how does one get a call from James? I mean, how did you first meet James Patterson?
Actually, there is a link on my website to a piece that I wrote called The Jim I Knew, which appears on jamespatterson.com. And essentially, I had been in the advertising business, and then somewhere in the middle 80s, I wound up deciding the punishment for being a good writer in advertising is to promote you and put you in charge of all the other writers, and suddenly you're not writing. And so in order to get back to what I like to do, I started writing. I wrote a play, and it didn't run on Broadway, but it ran almost everywhere else, all over the country and regional theaters, and it was published, and then people in show business, saw it, and I started writing pilots, and by the late 80s, I was in Los Angeles and working on television shows, and I hated it, and so I semi-quit my job around Thanksgiving, I think it was in 1989, and I came back to New York. I say semi-quit my job because they made me come back after New Year's. And just at that time, I got a call from a headhunter who said, could you freelance for Jim Patterson?
Wow.
And I said, he was the creative director of J. Walter Thompson,
right?
Which was probably then the biggest agency in the world. And I said, who? She goes, James Patterson. And I, of course, said, who's James Patterson? at that point, he was the worldwide creative director of J. Walter Thompson, and somehow we just hit it off right away. And I worked with him for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I went back to L.A., but he stayed in touch, and whenever I could help him out, I helped him out. And somehow we became friends, and I went back on summer hiatus the following year, and somewhere around that time, he said, I want you to read this manuscript. Tell me what you think of it. And the manuscript was for a book called Along Came a Spider. And I said, yeah, you sound like, the manuscript. And yeah, I said, Jim, I'm thinking you can quit your day job. This is, you know, and eventually he did, and we stayed in touch. And
so you've known him all the way from the beginning.
Known him from the beginning, and then we stayed in touch. And when I decided, first of all, I think it was like 1996. God, you people must think I'm old.
You're not really old.
Good thing this is in television. No, hey, look, kid, when I was your age, Pluto was a planet. That's how old I am.
Right.
No, but I am.
At least you can laugh about it, you know?
I'm old, but I'm number one on the news.
But here you are with Kill Me If You. We shouldn't talk about Kill Me If You Can.
Anyway, I don't know where I was, and I'm sure nobody else does at this point. But in 1996, when I thought, I had lunch with Jim, and I said, you know, I want to write. I have an idea for a book. And I pitched to him the book back then that became The Rabbit Factory.
Oh, okay.
And within the course of that lunch, he said, okay, but what if, and you know, and it kicks up a notch, and I go, wow. And then, what if, and it kicks up, and within one lunch, he helped me, you know, raise the suspense level and get the plot much more interesting. And ultimately, when I started it, I didn't know that it would be about Hollywood. I knew it would be about this big corporation. He said, what corporation? He said, if you make it the phone company or, you know, electric company, you're dead. He said, it's got to be interesting. And I thought, what's interesting? And I realized I had just spent a number of years in Hollywood, and
uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, that. And so I created this Disney company with characters that really ring true if you've been to Hollywood or worked there, and they're interesting, even though there's a kind of overlay of someone trying to put a business out of business, it's much more interesting than a business story. And so Jim got me started. Jim has helped me along the way, and he has been a great friend and a great guy to work with.
Right. Well, that's really cool. Now, Kill Me If You Can. Let's talk about Kill Me If You Can, your book. Now,
yes.
This is different than any of his other co-written. I mean, I find it very, very different. I find the humor different. I find the style of the writing a lot different. So I like that. It's refreshing.
I like that you find it different. And essentially, you know, the difference is that I wrote it. And I say that not like chest beating. It's just that Jim found a story that he thought would work with my sensibilities and my sense of humor.
And he was right.
And some of the happiest reviews that I have read, you know, come from people who do notice the difference from one co-author to another, and who have said that, you know, the James Patterson Marshall Karp collaboration is seamless. You get the, you know, driving suspense that Patterson always provides, and the quirky, you know, humor, character-driven crap that Karp does.
Right. You sound very quirky. I mean, you're a very interesting man. I mean, just talking to you, I hear all the different interests in your voice, and your voice actually changes pitches at one time or another. It's really interesting how you are. And this book is, of course, what would it feel like to find a load of diamonds? We'd all love to find diamonds. If I found diamonds, I don't think I'd ever tell anybody.
Well, that, Neil, it's... who among us has not purchased a lottery ticket and then thought, what would I do with $13 million or $60 million, whatever it is? It's like coming into that kind of sudden wealth is you know boggles the mind.
It does.
So here's this young guy at Grand Central Terminal in New York. He's a 20-something art student, and a former Marine, and he's a good guy, and he finds these diamonds, and he's not sure what to do with them, but he kind of knows that the diamonds belong to some thug who probably got them illegally, and now he makes a decision that's about to change his life. He's going to keep the diamonds and, you know, cash them in. And unfortunately, the diamonds belong to the Russian mafia. And so then the chase is on, literally around the world.
And it makes for a very, very interesting read. I mean, it's like I said, it's very different, and I like that. And how do you, when you think of a story, when you thought of the story, when you thought the story up, did you think of the whole story, or did parts of it? No, wait.
Let me set the record straight. The way Jim works is, and I think this is basically the way he does it with all co-authors,
mm-hmm.
He provides a story outline.
He actually does that.
Jim,
okay.
I mean, remember, his name and his brand are on the book. So it has to be a story that he wants to tell. And I think the amazing thing about Mr. Patterson is how many stories he has in his head. You could sit down and have lunch with him, and he could just spin 12 great plots for a book that he hasn't even had time to write yet. He never runs out of plots.
Now, does he make up the titles too, or did you have a say in the title?
In this case, he absolutely made up the title. The good news is for I don't know if it's great news for your listeners, but it's really happy news for me. After this collaboration, I came up with a story. He said, "Let's do another book," and I came up with a story, and he liked it. And then I came up with a title, and he loved it.
Is it hard for him to like an idea from somebody else? Is that very unusual?
Not at all. He's Jim is probably the smartest marketing person on the planet. He understands that he is a brand, and he has millions of readers around the world, and he wants to provide them with the experience. The predictable emotional experience that they want from when they buy a James Patterson book.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a good idea, he doesn't take pitches, but in this case, it happened that that's the way this new book evolved. And he liked the story, he liked the characters, and as I'm writing it, he has, he edits. Sometimes he edits with more of a stern hand on it, and sometimes he's very loose. And in the case of Kill Me If You Can, especially in the beginning, he made me cut back on some of the humor. And he said, this is third person talking right here, and what you said is really funny. But the third person narrator can't be funny. He can't have funny point of view, because that's you, and it's going to sound like shtick. It has to come. Let the humor come from the character and from the situation, which I have done in my other books, but my other books are written all first person, so right. The narrator can get away with being funny.
Right.
In the case of a Patterson book, it's
Right. Is he always right in what he suggests? Do you find him always being...
I find him often brilliant, okay?
Now, but you came up with ideas, too.
Oh, yeah, like if he says Matthew goes to Amsterdam and he has to sell the diamonds in an interesting, well-researched, you know, well-developed way, that's on me. So it's not that I came up with a big story, but when Matthew takes off Amsterdam, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. is anyone else there? No, it's every now and then the phone clicks, but, right. You know, and so I'm looking at Jim would give me like a 4,000-word outline where he breaks it down, prologue one, prologue two, chapter one, chapter two, all the way through. Some of his chapters will be spelled out in 12 words, one sentence. And so now I have to figure out, okay, Matthew's going to get to Amsterdam. Who is he going to sell the diamonds to? How is he going to do it? What's the jeopardy? So, yeah, it's my job to flesh out Jim's outline.
Right. And he'll tell you whether it's working or not. I mean, he knows.
Quote him, yeah, he'll tell you. To quote him, you get to add, but you don't get to subtract. Which means that if I say, oh, God, Jim, do we really need this sex scene here? And he'll go, yeah, they'll love it. I go, okay.
So he has an uncanny he knows what people like.
He knows he's that kind of in touch with his readers. He knows what they like, and he knows how to make things more James Patterson-like. And you know, and get you know, and get the book to where readers are going to buy it and love it and want to and can't wait for the next one, which usually comes about 4 weeks later. At this point, that's almost scary.
Exactly, it is. It's just amazing how many books he has a year, 9, 11, whatever it is, and it just seems to grow and
well,
grow.
Well, I believe his next 2 years he'll have 26 in 2 years. Now, he does, they're not all in the murder mystery genre. He has young adult books,
right.
The Daniel X series, and he's really very big. He has his whole program, literacy program for kids.
Which is wonderful.
Out, read, kiddo, read. And we did a radio interview together on NPR, and even though, you know, there was a new book out to talk about, Jim really wanted to focus on talking about Read, Kiddo, Read, because it does a lot. It does a lot for the community out there to encourage children to read.
That's a wonderful thing.
Back in, you know, the Kill Me If You Can was supposed to release in June, and he decided to push it till August because in June he wanted to release two books at one time.
Oh, right, yes, yes.
And that was the one he released, one for the parents, which is, you know, Now You See Her.
Right.
And one that you could buy for your kids, which was, you know, Middle School, The Worst Years of My Life. And he said, Kill Me If You Can didn't quite go with that pair. And I understand. And, you know, he does a lot for literacy and for just general teaching kids the value of a good book.
What do you think people are going to like about Kill Me If You Can? I mean, what is it about the book that you think?
I think they will like the action. I think they have absolutely definite characters to root for. You got this guy, Matthew Bannon.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, in it, you know, just a really likable young guy in this dilemma. He is head over heels in love with his art teacher, who's not that much older than he is. And Matthew and Catherine kind of at the last minute go on this worldwide junket. They go to Paris and they go to Venice and they go to Amsterdam. And she, of course, doesn't know that he has a bag full of diamonds with him. She's not in on it with him. And then you have not just one, but two assassins. assassins looking for them.
Exactly.
So it's got that, and then you've got characters to hate. You've got this, Russian mafia, and I did, someone, God, my Aunt Pearl called me and said, "How do you know so much about the Russian mafia?"
Oh.
And I said, "Oh, we didn't tell you? My dad was in." She goes, "No, really." I said, "Research. You watch movies. You go online. You find out the reality of the Russian mafia, and then you incorporate it into characters that have the ring of truth." I do a lot of research in my books. I am a cop junkie. I hang out with cops.
Oh, do you?
I spent 3 hours when I was writing Bloodthirsty. I spent 3 hours in the business end of the Los Angeles County Morgue, because so many books, or especially television, the morgue is always this pristine glass wall, sliding steel drawers. It's more like a Edgar Allan Poe novel or something out of Dickens, where the bodies are strewn all over on gurneys, some draped with a black cloth and others not draped at all, and it's like really 18th century. It's an 18th century morgue,
right?
And I wanted to get the reality, so that when because Bloodthirsty, the morgue was a key venue at Bloodthirsty. And that's what I do. So research is part of writing, and, you're not allowed to... Yeah, you do have a poetic license. And, in Kill Me If You Can, Matthew finds the diamonds, during an attack on Grand Central Terminal, and they have been hidden or stashed away in a locker that is open.
So did you actually go to Grand Central
Station? Oh, yeah. By the way, there are no lockers in Grand Central Station because there haven't been lockers there, since the 70s, because, after, you put a bomb, go to an airport, go to a train station or a bus terminal, try to find a locker where you put a quarter in. You can't, because, it's become a terrorist device. But yes, I spent hours and hours in Grand Central Terminal, and the funny thing is I was walking around with a camera taking tons, hundreds of pictures, and I'm thinking, God, the cops are going to stop me, and they're going to just think I'm a terrorist. And it turned out that the day I was there, there were tons of people with cameras. One group was actually shooting a commercial, because it's for rent. If you want to shoot something there for movies or for commercials, and tourists were just taking pictures, so it was pretty easy. But yeah, I spent a lot of time there. I did incorporate Venice, Amsterdam, Paris, and the Bahamas into the book, and I had actually, in the course of my lifetime, been in all those places.
You had a very interesting life.
Well, it's not done.
No.
I'm hoping that this is the final frontier. I when I was just around the time I was turning 40, I got that feeling that so many people do in their early 40s, and it's like, is this all there is? Here's where I am, and now I'm looking at the back nine. Am I just going to keep doing this for the rest of my life? And I was already a very successful creative director at an advertising agency. And I said, no. When I'm 60, I want to be living in upstate New York. I had a house up there. It's where I am now. When I'm 60, right, I want to be living in upstate New York, writing murder mysteries. And
you're still writing the Lomax and Biggs.
And that's the way it turned out. And I realized that, we often get into this midlife crisis and this midlife trap because we're living the dream of some 19-year-old kid. It wasn't the 40-year-old me who decided to get into advertising. It was the 19-year-old me who thought advertising would be cool. So now the 40-year-old me decided to plan for the 60-year-old me. And he did a, he did a really good job. And so this is, then I wound up from advertising to the television and film business, and I wound up in the internet business, but I slowly worked my way up to be able to write what I thought would be fun to write, and hoped it would be fun and profit, but it's just, the nice thing is that no matter what age I am, as long as my brain and two of my fingers are working, I have a job.
Right. And you enjoy you enjoy writing.
I love it. And
there's never any days you don't love it.
I hope Jim doesn't listen to this, but I would do it. I would do it if I weren't getting paid. That's what I like to do.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
What were you going to ask?
No, I said there's never any days where you just say you're sick of it or you just can't do it.
No, it's like sex or chocolate.
I guess that's true of most authors. I mean, why else would you...
I'm sick of this sex and chocolate.
Right.
Well, I'm never sick of it, ever. It's how I always communicated.
Even with the rewrites and going through it again and again and again?
Oh, it can be, it can be. You can have your tough days. But the thing about...
Do you ever get time to read yourself? It sounds like you're just busy writing all the time.
That's embarrassing. That's an embarrassing question because every writer has plenty of time to read, and I'm a bad reader. I'm a lip-moving...
Are you a picky reader?
No. I think I'm a little ADD.
You read all of James Patterson's books, right?
No, not true. not true at all. I couldn't.
I don't know who could.
There are people who really can. I'm a slow, I'm literally a knuckle-dragging, lip-moving, heavy-breathing, Neanderthal reader. So when I start a book, and often it's very funny, when I read a James Patterson book, I think about what it would be like if I had even before I was a co-author, I've said to Jim at various times, I would have done more with this character. I know him well enough to say that, and he's successful enough that he doesn't have to listen to me.
Right. Now, do you think the pacing of Kill Me If You Can is faster than your normal books?
Absolutely. It is Patterson-esque in its pacing. As Jim once said to me, all this... Jim wrote, I think, three, maybe more books before Along Came the Spider. They were very well written, and they were written in the more classic murder mystery tradition.
Right.
Describe what the scene looks like. And he finally... they weren't selling, and he finally realized that he had to write something that only gave people the parts that they enjoy reading. And so a lot of the description is gone. The chapters are very short. There's a hook at the end that you want to get to the next chapter. And even though my books tend to be longer and I develop character more, I really caught on to the somewhat short chapter, and the hook 'em at the end, make 'em a button at the end of every chapter so they want to keep reading.
Right.
But what Jim told me once is, he said, I used to live across the street from Alexander Haig, the former Secretary of State. I don't know who's listening. Maybe they never heard of him. But anyway, he said, he said, if I would have opened my door in the morning and see Alexander Haig lying dead in a pool of blood in front of his house, I would not describe the house. And that's true. He gets to the action.
Right.
And
well, you got to keep the reader interested.
You got to, and there are places where you get to do some description and some some background, but often he'll reserve the background on a character till chapter 46 because it's not important until you really get to be involved with the character.
Right. Like your book Flipped Out, which is absolutely brilliant. It's my favorite of all your books. There's something about that book that really resonated with me.
Just in case anybody out there wanted to buy it. Let's call it Flipping Out.
Oh, it is Flipping Out. Oh, you're
flipping
right.
Out by
right.
Marshall Karp. And it's for sale at a bookstore near you.
Boy, am I embarrassed now.
No, hey. Listen, George.
See, you've forgotten my name, so.
Yeah, there you go.
You know why I say Flipped Out? Because there's a movie out called Flipped Out, and I was getting confused with that. Anyway.
Interestingly enough, titles are not copyrightable, and you can do...
But it is Flipping
Out. My first book is called The Rabbit Factory.
Right.
And about 6 months before it came out, another book came out called The Rabbit Factory, completely different...
Interesting.
Genre, and...
Did you know it was coming out along with yours?
I had the title years before.
Okay.
I knew it came out, and both my publisher and James Patterson said, doesn't matter. And now if you type The Rabbit Factory into Google, happily, mine comes up first. And I wound up buying the other guy's book kind of just as a tribute.
That's great. And The Rabbit Factory is a long book, too, as I recall.
The Rabbit Factory is, in hardcover, it's 632 pages. The average Patterson book is, forget the page count, the average Patterson book is 70,000 words. That's about the length. The Rabbit Factory is double that. It's close to 140,000 words.
You had a lot to say with that book.
Well, I didn't know when to shut up. It was my first book. I had, not only did I have a B plot, I think I had a C plot. I probably went down to W in terms of plots. But, I did, hopefully in the Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm tradition, I was able to tie all the plots together neatly. But my publisher at the time said to me, when I said 632 pages, and they're very generous pages in terms of big type and very, very readable, and I said, maybe we should cut it down. He said, you know what? This is a book that's really easy to read, and people are going to get into it, and they're not going to be able to stop reading. And you know what people do after they read a 600-page book? They tell everybody. They don't shut up about it. In fact,
right.
Most of the email I got was, I couldn't believe it was 632 pages, but that didn't, I could have handled more. It was like this, didn't matter if it was a man or a woman, it's like so proud of my reading skills that I could gobble up this, novel.
Right, and then Bloodthirsty was a lot shorter, though.
Well, yeah, that's because suddenly I was working for a publisher who said, and now give me 70,000 words. I wrote The Rabbit Factory on spec. So anybody out there who wants to be a writer, if you've listened this far, I will give you the best free advice I've given any person who wants to write, and that is that there are a million people out there who can prevent you from becoming a published author. And there's only one person who can stop you from being a writer. And that's you.
That's yourself.
So if you want to write, just write. And that's what I did with The Rabbit Factory.
Now, how many words?
I wanted to write the book.
Now, how many words are there in Kill Me If You Can? I mean, you said about 70,000, but...
I don't know the final count, but yeah, that's about it.
Does James Patterson count every word? Does he make sure?
Oh, no, well, you don't sit here and count them. You basically have a thing in Microsoft Word that...
Oh, okay.
You now have 64,812 words. Count, So it's easy.
But how does somebody like you, who is used to having longer chapters, suddenly change and write shorter chapters?
No, I've been writing shorter chapters. The Rabbit Factory, with all its words, had 115 chapters.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, you didn't read it, David. You really should. It's available. You know, it's available in ebook. If you go to my website, you can get it for only $2.99 on ebook.
Well, I started later in your series.
I know you work in a bookstore, but even
yes.
Then, you know, a lot of bookstores won't have the Rabbit Factory now. That's why I've offered it on ebook, both the Rabbit Factory and Bloodthirsty, to try and get people interested in the series.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to become more interested in you because you're a New York Times best-selling author, number one. So,
well, I've got...
They're going to say, who is this Marshall Clark? We've got to read him. What else has he done?
That was part of the hope. And actually...
Don't you think of yourself as a good writer?
I think of myself as, you know, between you and me and that one guy who still is listening.
Yeah, that's right.
Are we allowed to curse on the internet?
Yeah, sure.
I'm pretty fucking good. I really am. People like my style. I think my last two books that I did with another publisher from the first two, the Flipping Out and Cut, Paste, Kill, I think the publisher had trouble positioning me because even though the murder mysteries are really good, I develop characters that I think are three-dimensional. I develop characters that people write me all the time, oh my God, Mike Lomax's father is such a meddling son of a bitch. He's just like my mother. He's just
right.
Like my father.
So people identify.
And
once people
identify
with the characters. Identify
with the characters. And my characters, there's always somebody or more than one somebody who can be funny because I hang out with a lot of cops. Even when I was at the morgue, anybody who works in this dark business, a death business,
right,
they have to be funny to let off steam. I mean, literally, the Los Angeles County Morgue, you know, has a gift shop. You can go there, you can buy gifts online, and they have great stuff. I have a jacket with the coroner's logo, which is just
cool.
An outline of a dead body, and it says L.A. County Coroner. But, you know, they have, you know, barbecue aprons that say, you know, barbecue ribs, legs, arms, you know. And then when you go in, it says, if you were cashing a check, we'll need two forms of identification or dental records. I mean, people in the dark businesses have to be funny to cope with life. And I let my cops have a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. That's why comedians live so long. Do you think George Burns lived so long? He was so funny. I mean, he just laughed all the time.
Yes. I actually met George Burns.
Oh, really?
You know. Well, yeah. I met him when I was shooting a commercial years and years ago. Hey, guy who's listening, I hope you're old enough to know.
Everybody knows George Burns. I mean,
yeah, but I hope you're old enough to know Payne Webber. Payne Webber was a brokerage firm.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the 70s, nobody ever heard of him. So my art director and I came up with a campaign, basically showing people kind of like really enjoying the good life. You know, polo or whatever, and they would just look at the camera and say, "Thank you, Payne Webber."
Right.
And it the implication was, hey, if you invest with us, you may have the good life, which was, we couldn't promise anything. We could just look cool. And so every commercial had a celebrity in it. We had Lauren Bacall. We had George Burns. We had Bugs Bunny. And George Burns shows up, and his agent would not let him smoke the cigar in the shot. I said, but that's George Burns without a cigar. It's like, he said, no, he's talking to a pipe tobacco company about some possible commercials. He said, but he's got three different suits. He can do the scene for you in three different outfits. They said, no, one outfit is fine. George Burns was a riot in person and on camera.
And we ought to talk about Joe Drabiak, who you dedicate this book to. And
oh, my God. Yeah, Joe Drabiak and I met right after The Rabbit Factory came out.
And you both have weird sense of humor, which made it so much.
We met. I was in Portland, Oregon, at one of these Winter Institute kind of, writers and booksellers getting together. And I was having breakfast by myself, and Joe was having breakfast with another writer. I didn't know who he was. And I overheard him talking to the writer, saying about how he was a character in several books, and he really enjoyed that.
Right.
And so after the guy left, I looked over at Joe, and I said, I couldn't help but overhear you. You're in these books, and let me introduce myself. And I did, and he goes, Marshall Karp, The Rabbit Factory. I said, did you read the book? He goes, I read the manuscript.
Wow.
He said, the salesman for McAdam Cage brought it to me because he knew I'd like it. And, and I said, would you like to be a character in my next book? And he goes, oh, yeah, it'd be great. I said, does it matter? He said, no, you can make me he said, I've been every kind. You can make me anything. You can make me a cowboy. You can make me a detective. You can make me a hat. I don't care.
Yeah, he got boiled in oil in one of the books.
By the way, Joe, just curious, what is your wife's name? And he said, oh, my wife is Reggie. And so I was in the middle of writing Flipping Out, and I made Joe Drabiak into a woman who was the first murder victim.
That's great.
And Joe Drabiak's husband's name is Reggie. And Joe loved the book so much that when I came down to Chester County to, do a book signing, he introduced me, and he showed up, as promised, he showed up in drag, dressed as Joe Drabiak with the flower dress. And there's still pictures of him and me on my website. Joe was a guy who loved people. He loved books. He loved life. And everybody adored him. And he was a champion of the independent bookseller.
And he still lives on in spirit.
Oh, God, yes. Joe was a of up-and-coming writers.
Absolutely.
I think...
And we need more people like that to get this.
He told me that once James Patterson said, how do I get to be a Joe's pick, at your bookstore?
That's right,
and
yes.
Joe said, you don't. He said, everybody knows who you are. I go with guys like Marshall Karp. I go with Robert Ellis. People that nobody knows. And if I endorse them, people believe me. And Joe was a wonderful man, and he got terminally ill at a very young age and died last year, and it was tragic. I
never heard him complain about his illness either.
I talked to him until the very end, and he wanted to go out like Joe. They offered him some surgery that would have, and this is getting, depressing. Hey, guy, cheer up, who's listening.
That's right.
Anyway, Joe
I'm sure
wanted
there's more
to go out with, like Joe, and he did go out like Joe. He went out like the way he lived. He didn't want the kind of surgery that could affect his brain or his thinking. And everyone who knew him loved him. He was the head of North Atlantic Independent Booksellers, NABA.
Mm-hmm. NABA.
And everybody depended on him. And I remember there were several times he went to St. Martin's, my publisher at the time, and he said, I'm going to show up and drag to promote Marshall Karp's book. What the hell are you guys doing?
Oh, wow.
Oh, he did. Yeah. And who he was. He became my champion, but he quickly became my friend. I don't know how the bond. I mean, everybody loved him, but we kind of stayed connected in a special way, and I couldn't have dedicated the book to anyone else but Joe.
Right.
And it says, in memory of my good friend and partner in crime, Joe Drabiak.
So we can, and that's wonderful. And thank you for doing that. It means a lot to a lot of people. It's a thrill to see that. It really is. And I'm very pleased that you did that.
Wow.
But we can expect more of Lomax and Biggs now? Maybe next year?
The book that I am currently writing with James Patterson is not Lomax and Biggs. It's, you know...
Oh, okay. You are currently writing one with him. Okay.
I am writing this next one. He loves the idea. He loves the title. And I am in love with the book.
We can't know the title?
Absolutely not. I'd have to kill you and that guy who still won't.
Yeah, but now the guy that was listening is going to stop listening.
Yeah, I know, but no. Because, you know, titles are stealable, and it's just that kind of
title. I promise I won't steal it.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Even though I write for love, and I write what I enjoy writing.
And reading.
There's a fine line in this business between art and commerce. And even though I'd love to write a bunch more Lomax and Biggs books, I can't do it just yet, because Lomax and Biggs, which has had limited promotion and, you know, limited marketing and limited publicity, it just, you know, there's no demand for a fifth book, which is why...
So you don't have a story in mind?
Oh, I have stories, absolutely, but there's no demand for it.
Yeah.
And so I would rather...
Well, speak for yourself there. I think there is a demand for it. Not enough of the demand? Is that what you mean?
There's not enough people. Well, let me put it this way. Yes, there is a demand among the Lomax and Biggs fans.
That's right. And
but there is no publisher who says, wow, I want to jump on the Lomax and Biggs bandwagon because Marshall has sold, what, dozens of books.
So what's the chances of you and James Patterson writing a series of books together?
Very, very, very good. The one that I am working on now is a natural for a series.
Does he want to make it a series?
He hasn't lied to me in the past.
That's good.
And I don't want to say what James wants to do, but it has the potential for a series. I think the only thing that will make it a series is when the first one gets published, will people say, I love these characters.
Right.
I want to see it again.
Can you tell us anything about the plot at all?
Absolutely nothing.
Not even the first word?
The first word? I would have to look up the first word. No, I actually, you know what? I can't tell you the first word because it would give something away. That's how... I can tell you this.
The first word would give something away?
Yeah, I'm not kidding you.
Wow.
When you read the first word, you'll understand what I meant. I'm not kidding you. But, the first word is prologue. No.
Oh, that doesn't tell me anything.
No, just kidding. I mean the first word in the first chapter.
You're nothing but a tease, you know that?
Please, all the girls tell me that. Where was I going with this?
I don't know.
I was going to tell you something about it, and then you just cut me right off.
I know, but it was fun.
Yeah. Lomax and Biggs takes place in Los Angeles. They're a crack homicide team for Los Angeles Police Department. And they solve crimes in Hollywood, and for the most part, especially in the first two books, I kill off a lot of the assholes I used to work with in Hollywood.
Oh, what fun that must be.
Yeah, oh, it's very cathartic, let me tell you.
And you know who those people are, too.
Oh, I know. I might have called the guy Barry Gerber, but I know who he is.
Yeah.
Okay? And
I think I know who he is, too.
Let's not say it without clearing it with the lawyers. But the one I'm writing now takes place in... this potential series takes place in New York City, and I love it because I spent, you know, most of my adult, I'm in upstate New York, but I spent my adult life in New York City, and I think of myself as a New Yorker, and I it's so much fun to write about New York City. I can just close my eyes and picture where I am, and I, you know, if I'm on a street corner, I know the feeling that's going on that street corner, and it's so much easier and more real to write something in that takes place in a venue that you know. When I was writing Amsterdam and Paris and Venice, I had to do a lot of research and a lot of recollecting. By the way, in terms of is there a possible more Lomax and Biggs? I don't know if you know this, but a studio and a network, network, you know, TNT and Lionsgate, ordered a pilot of Lomax and Biggs. And it did not, it was produced last, you know, it was finished like in early January or February.
And it had a star, too, didn't it?
It had Steven Weber and D.L. Hughley, two television personalities.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. Terry Biggs is not. Terry Biggs in the book is white. D.O. Hughley in real life tends to play black.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Maybe because he is.
Yeah. But they were good. But I think that it was not developed quite right, and so.
Did you see the pilot?
Oh God, yeah. I was not involved in it, but I was.
What was your first impression when you saw it?
I loved seeing my work come to life, and then the second time I saw it, I realized that I knew what was missing, and I sensed that it would not do well at the network or in testing, and interestingly enough, it didn't, and so they didn't go with it, and I'm happy, because I thought directionally... It was the wrong way to develop the characters.
So what is it? Right.
And I may there may be a chance to resuscitate it. Now it doesn't mean you can recut the film, but it just means that at some point, if someone is somebody owns it right now, but if someone wants to take a shot at redeveloping the series, it's a good shot. I mean, they are such a natural for television. Lomax and Biggs are. Television is a predictable emotional experience.
Well, look about it. Can be like
you watch television because you want to see what the characters.
Right. It could be a male version of Rizzoli and Isles.
Well, it's the same thing. There's Rizzoli and Isles. There's Franklin and Bash. There's
Right. Although I don't like Isles though. I have problems with Isles.
Burns and Allen. No. Yeah. Well. Who doesn't like Rizzoli?
Yeah, well, exactly. But that's another story altogether. But.
Yes.
But what is it about this new series that you're working on that's so much different from anything you've ever written? Can you tell me that? Or is that giving away too much, too?
No, I think the dynamic between the two central characters is very different. And to give away one little thing, the two central characters are male and female instead of two guys.
Oh, that should be interesting.
When
can we expect this out in the bookstores, and when can we go pick up a copy?
It's on a fast track. I don't know when.
How fast?
I'm going to finish writing it and submit it to the publisher in about a month.
Now, Little Brown's going to publish it?
I am not 100% sure.
Oh, okay.
If it will be Little Brown or their new mystery.
They're
which is called Mulholland.
Mulholland, yeah.
But it will have my name and James's name on it. But it's kind of interesting, and I think it potentially could be out in 2012.
Have you ever been to James Patterson's house for dinner?
No.
Never? Would you ever like to go?
Yeah, I would. James lives in the New York area in the summertime, and he lives in Florida the rest of the year where his son goes to school.
Oh, cool.
And I have been to James's house in New York, but when we had lunch, we went out.
And how many kids does he have?
One.
Just one kid. Oh, that's it.
Yeah. And, I mean, I can say that comfortably because James talks about his kid and how the Read Kiddo Read program was something that Jim and his wife really started when their kid got to be that reading age and was resisting reading. So.
Well, we've just about run out of time. It's been a while.
Oh, thank God.
It's funny, I was thinking the same thing.
I'm bored already. God, I'd like to say thank you to that one guy who's still listening.
I think there's more than... I get 140,000 hits a month. What are you kidding, one guy?
But who listens for an hour?
I don't know, but somebody will, because you...
Well, if that guy is still listening, here's the deal. Go to my website, which is LomaxandBiggs.com, LomaxandBiggs.com, and tell me that you actually listen to this crap, and tell me if it actually was worth the hour. Tell me if it's going to generate any book sales for James or for David or even for moi.
Even though I don't have a book, you know?
Well, you have a bookstore.
That's
don't
true.
Don't know where to find your bookstore.
That's true, if you're looking at it that way.
You have the best independent bookstore in the world.
That's true. But I don't think of it as me making any
money.
Well,
I know, but you know?
But it helped. It's certainly satisfying.
If you drove 140,000 people to stand outside your door one day, your boss would give you a raise.
I think you're right.
Yeah, the fire marshals would be there too, but still.
That's right.
Anyway, it's amazing that we were able to talk for 1 hour straight.
And I've enjoyed it immensely.
And my dog did not bark to say, "Can I come in, please?"
That's
great. Because, you know, as I told you just before we started, I may be a number one New York Times best-selling author, but you know what I got to do today? I got to drive the garbage to the dump. best-selling author guy.
It really brings you back down to earth, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like, I just posted on Facebook, the reality check, which is, a new fan goes, "Wow, how awesome, number one best-selling author." And my wife of 40 years goes, "Hey, number one best-selling author, drive the garbage to the dump."
Well, that's part of life, too, you know?
Hey, look, it keeps me grounded.
I bet even James Patterson's emptied his garbage at one point or another, too.
he does not live like... When, interestingly enough, he's a pretty simple guy. He actually... When we went out to lunch, we drove. He doesn't have a car and driver. He can well afford one. He's pretty...
Right.
Very down-to-earth guy from Newburgh, New York. And,
I can't wait to read the new series. I'm looking... Let me know what I can.
I can't wait to write it. David. No, it's doing what I do is fun, and I thought this would be like hard work, but you made it easy, so...
Thank you very much. And the book, again, is Kill Me If You Can. It's out from Little Brown, and all your books is number one in the New York Times.
By
Marshall Karp and James Patterson.
You said it in a reverse order, but they understand.
I'm sure they do. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.